Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Second half on this Wednesday, and I frequently make reference to rip from today's headlines when we talk about what comes across the wire. And so, earlier in the week, I expected Sid and I to riff on Twirling Candy getting a classic winner and the really fun story that the Fratkins had involving their mare and just one of two, and how this is a horse that normally you heard John explain yesterday, normally would have gone through the ring. But pandemic has written some interesting narratives. Well, then news came late yesterday afternoon, early evening, that Malibu Moon, cardiac incident in his paddock at 24. And, there are some stallions, Sid, that we stop and appreciate. Josh Pond started the conversation earlier this morning, and I was hoping you would continue it. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I enjoyed Josh Pond's visit. I mean, he's really the guy that can tell you about the horse, and he did. But, to put this in perspective, and there are a couple of things about this horse that, some people might not know. But the first thing is put it in perspective. I frequently get snickers from people about a stallion made only two lifetime career starts, broke down on the track. Why is he at stud? Kind of stuff. And well, here's the reason why they do it. Because here's a horse that started up for 3,000, as Josh Pond said, all they did was try to hustle as many mares as they could to him. And as John Sikora has frequently said, and we quoted him ad nauseum on your show, some stallions switch the light switch on, and he did. And that's what's really incredible about it. Now, I told you there's a couple of things people don't know about this horse. Francis Caron, my associate and the bloodstock editor at WTC, she used to work at Walmac, which is where the dam Macumba resided. Macumba was bred by Freddie Head, under his name Janice Bloodstock. The Heads had a relationship with another big French family, the Deschambure family of Etraham. The father was Roland Deschambure, and the Heads and the Chambure family had several partnerships, one of which was Societe Allende. They raised some great Mr. Prospector fillies, like Ravenella, for example, like Macumba, who was a G1 winner at two. She ended up at the end of her racing career was sold to B. Wayne Hughes privately. Francis has written about this in the past in our blog, and so she came to Walmac, where she stayed there. And by the way, her half brother, Septi MCL, who's by AP Indy, out of their dam, Maximova, was standing at Walmac at the time, too. So Mr. Hughes bought this mare privately, had her there. Now, you can understand, as Josh Pons has told you about, people using a nick or a family, female family success to redo it over and over again. Well, of course, SEPTMCO was by Seattle Slu. So B. Wayne Hughes sent Macumba to AP Indy, Seattle Slu's son, got Malibu Moon. Now, here's the part people don't know. This colt, while he was at the farm, and Francis knows this pretty well, he broke two sesamoids when he was a weanling. which, you know, is usually the kiss of death, but this horse's fortitude, he still was able to get to the track with those injuries as a weanling, and got to the track early. I mean, both his dam, Macumba, was a two-year-old G1 winner, and her dam was a G1 winner, I believe, at two as well. Got to the track early. Of course, Mr. Prospector, you know, speed influence. Lost his debut in April, came back and won his next start in May as a two-year-old, and then fractured a knee, and he was done. Mr. Hughes, though, persevered with him, and it's a testament to him that he did. And Josh Pond, the Pond family was involved, obviously, in Country Life, and then later Kathleen Lyons in Kentucky took a piece, and then finally when Mr. Hughes bought Spencer, the horses moved there. So during this entire period, this horse made it on his own. And, you know, think about it. You got a Kentucky Derby winner. The Phippses and the Jannies actually bred that Derby winner, but they would never have bred to him when he was standing for $3,000 at Country Life, right? So it just shows you how this horse was a phenomenal story.
There were a few things that Josh said that I didn't pursue because I knew I would bring them up with you. And one thing that I don't think I've seen mentioned in, I've only seen, I think, two or three obituaries, as it were, a horse that we touch on now and then, because his success in his region is so remarkable. But Parker Stormcat, I don't know if people realize that Malibu Moon is a half brother of the West Virginia sensation. I didn't see him referenced in any obit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the mare's fourth foal. Malibu Moon was the first, and then she was bred to Danzig twice, and then she was bred to Stormcat, got Parker Stormcat. And as you pointed out, you know, the mare never, by the way, had a stakes winner, unless she had one recently, because, but you know, she's succeeded in her own way. And, of course, she's a Temple City's from this immediate family as well, the horse that stands at Spencer right now.
Pretty funny.
Stallions from this family.
Well, and there's also, if I'm not mistaken, I think the sister that mutually benefit, does she have something productive to that family?
She was stakes placed. She very well could.
She had a good horse for Craig Burnick and Proctor, and she was okay.
Yeah.
I see the name and it just kind of caught my eye. That I just know that, you know, that it,
let me just check and see that, because that Mutually Benefit is the Diner former stakes place mare, and who does she have?
Half sister. Compelled. Compelled.
Oh, yeah, Compelled. Very good. And Warfront. By the way, that's Warfront Dynaformer cross again of your mating, Mosler.
Well, and
here's his head again.
Exactly. And if you couldn't tell, I mean, I had so much fun last week with Josh Pons, and was so looking forward. I didn't expect we were going to be eulogizing Malibu Moon, but you want to talk about a font of history and a appreciation for the game's, you know, the majesty of the game, really, and a student of it. The Ponds, all the Ponses, I mean, they're just immersed, and you know, the regional appeal of Maryland as a, you know, as a hotbed of breeding and, you know, of quality racing and quality horse people. So I thank you for pointing, sending me in the Mosler direction.
Yeah, and also you, everything you said about the country life and the Ponzi's are so much on the mark. And on top of everything else, of course, they bring a literary
yes
component to their story too, as excellent writers, you know.
Very much, very much. Well, one thing about Makumba I want to mention, Sid, that I did bring up with Josh, the fact that she's a total outcross, and all the names, and particularly Maximova, the French mayor that dropped her. You look at that female family, Green Dancer, the first broodmare sire, then Swaps, then Hasty Road, then Crafty Admiral. It goes on, that Shutout, Balladeer, Gallant Fox, Roy Herod. You can see just how, you know, how many different interesting names and lines are involved, that, you know, you fold in AP Indy on the top and this female family, and you can understand how, you know, Malibu Moon just started lighting up mares.
Yeah, I mean, the pedigree is so big. So many, once again, you know, so many expert high-level horses and people have combined to make the story. Excuse me, not the least of which is Mr. Prospector as well. And AP Indy, because as Josh Pons pointed out to you, that cross has been absolutely phenomenal. You know, even in later versions, you know, when you take a look at a horse, for example, like Bernardini, son of AP Indy out of a, you know, Quiet American mare, you know, that's a Mr. Prospector line too. So there's this, as he correctly pointed out to you, you know, when you see one successful mating, it just gets repeated and repeated. That's how quote unquote these nicks form. And again, getting back to this horse, Malibu Moon, not a stakes winner. Didn't race at three. You know, and it takes somebody to believe in a horse like this,
right?
And to make it, and you know, this is probably an excellent example of what's honed Mr. Hughes's ethic through the years. You know, you succeed with a wild long shot like this, then you believe in a horse later on. You know, like Into Mischief. You know, at one point he stood for as little as 7,500. He's, you know, 225,000 now, or 250. And he has allowed people to get into the game by, like with Into Mischief, that Share the Upside program, which, you know, you breed a couple of mares to him every year and you get a free breeding right. So I think, you know, that democratization of bloodstock in a way probably has its roots with the success of Malibu Moon.
Well, the interesting. That's an interesting tie-in, actually, and it's funny because as you talked about and referenced Into Mischief, you know, Gary Young, when we were at Churchill together this year, I'm not sure even how it came up, but, you know, he said, you know, he watched Into Mischief's career, and he said, you know, you look at him and you wouldn't necessarily have thought, you know, is this going to be a breed shaping stallion? And he said, you know, no, not to look at him, you wouldn't have thought that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it echoes that.
Yeah, come out of, you know, you can throw Danzig into that too. You know, Danzig at the sire of Warfront, the Josh Pond reference in your conversation. You know, again, an unsound horse trained by Woody Stevens, three starts, three wins, lots of talent. But as with Now, the moon, you know, Woody Stevens convinced Seth Hancock to take a shot on this horse, Danzig, and they did. And, you know, look how incredible his career turned out to be.
And that, you know, that's one of the reasons. I mean, I expect we'll get a chance to talk to Ned Toffey at Spendthrift at some point soon. But I wanted to get to Josh because the courage to, you know, to invest in a horse like that, and you know, that's the key. And you and I have brought this up before. I mean, there's sometimes we come across, you come across a horse like Spanish Steps is the one I always reach for, because he was the brother of Unbridled Song. He got a chance, and we frequently come across those types. But here's a horse that didn't necessarily, you know, other than being a son of AP Indy, and you know, there wasn't something to hang your hat on that was so glaring.
Yeah, exactly. You know, having said that, it always takes that one individual that's the motivator behind it. In this case, it was B. Wayne Hughes, who's adamant about, you know, giving his horse a shot. You go back, say, even to the sire of deputy minister, vice regent, son of Northern Dancer, not a stakes winner, again, like these horses. He was a full brother to a champion, vice vice regent and vice, I forget. But vice regent, the lower performed horse, ended up being the breed shaper. And of course, it was E.P. Taylor that did that. So, you know, there's always, there's, in these types of horses, if somebody has seen something to say, you know what, he deserves a chance to go to stud. And usually it's because of the work of that one or a few people behind it that believe in the horse that, you know, helps. Of course, the horse needs to do his part.
We can use that as a segue to the conversation about the Preakness winner. And yesterday, the conversation I had with John Fradkin, and what he did with the mare, a Fleet mare, Ultra Fleet. I mean, she was, you know, not a producer of anything on the racetrack, and you know, he was told, you know, why would you possibly breed this mare? And next thing you know, she produces some downhill specialists, the likes of, you know, California Flag and the Nice Brother as well, or sister, actually. Oh, my God. Can't be a Corsa. Yeah. So, you know, you have different motivations. I mean, not to put our mayor in this category, but I've got, you know, sort of the same conclusion. I mean, we had Voltarine. She got hurt in her, you know, coming out of her second start with a sesamoid. And, you know, she's a big, you know, big, handsome filly. And I said, I got to give her a chance to, you know, to be a broodmare. And it's that same mentality that, you know, it's a different kind of investment, you know, that you're making, but you know, there's something in you that wants to go forward. And here they are two generations later, and they've got themselves a Preakness winner.
Yeah. And you know, you or whoever it is, you've seen some talent that makes you believe in that horse, right? Whether it's the mare or the stallion. And it's always great when, you know, it comes to fruition and something like that proves you right, whether in one generation or two, you know? I mean, that mare, Ultra Fleet, her daughter, her street sense daughter, ended up producing Roaring Lion, too.
Yeah. That's right. You know? John mentioned that. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's turned into a fantastic family. Now it's a massive family when you look at it, the page.
Yeah. And we brought up, you know, the other, the sibling who ran on Friday, Treasure Trove, which is pretty funny that, you know, to have siblings running in the 2 mile and 3/16 stakes on Friday and Saturday. It was a crazy harmony that came together. Talk about Twilight Twirling Candy in here, if you would, Sid, because, you know, you've sung his praises from, you know, from early on, actually. Some thoughts about what this means to him.
Well, you know, he's a stallion. By stallion, I've always liked Candy Ride. And some of the early Candy Ride stallions did not make it a stallion. But this horse has, in his own way, done it the hard way, too. And he's grown every year to the point where impossible to get into his book. He's become so popular the last few years, and he was an absolutely talented horse. Obviously, you know, he won the Malibu and other races, and he is one of those horses, Steve, that has continued over. You know, a lot of stallions kind of hit a brick wall. They hit that ceiling. There's a ceiling to them. And you figure, okay, that's all you can kind of expect from that stallion. He's showing what he is. This horse keeps breaking that ceiling. And that's what's exciting about Twirling Candy. And it must be for the people at Lane's End. Because he's showing, he keeps getting better with opportunity. And now he's starting to get some really high-quality mares. So I think, you know, when most people talk about, you know, horses that have kind of sort of proven themselves and they get high on them, it's usually, you know, a red herring. There might be a blip of success and it's really not going to carry forward. But this is a horse that keeps going. I mean, he's got Dream Shake as well as another 3-year-old that, you know, is going to have a pretty good career as well.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
You know, he's had the Good Philly Concrete Rose. I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff. Gift Box, he's got a son now, a stud. He's got a pretty good list of very good horses. And I think, like I said, he's going to have a lot of upside coming, which is rare for a stallion who's already kind of established.
And I'm just looking at, you mentioned the lifetime leading runners. It's got, I'll tell you, a nice balance. And actually, it's going to make me circle back to something with Malibu Moon before we wrap up, too, Sid. Don't let me forget that. But it looks like he's getting a nice balance of turf, dirt, short, long, male, female, too.
There's one thing that
jumps out to me, too. With that dam, with that House of Danzig, when it comes to Twirling Candy, and that is, you know, that she's a Chester House herself, and you know, you get that little Tussaud boost in there as well. There's more than just the Candy Ride on top. There's a female family that, you know, that really has got a lot going for it. There's stamina in there, and there's a little bit of everything. Really nice.
There is all that, and the breeder, you know, paid attention because Twirling Candy's sire, Candy Ride, has an exceptional relationship with Stormcat, that Nick, sort of Candy Ride Stormcat. And so what he did here with Twirling Candy is he sent the Stormcat line mirror because the dam Cashmere is by Cowboy Cal, the Son of Giants Causeway, you know, Son of Stormcat. So he's also used that that cross very well, which is, you know, the greater Candy Ride Stormcat Cross, and it's well thought out pedigree, and it's now it's a really big pedigree.
Nice.
Now, what were you going to say about Malibu Moon that you wanted to tie in?
Well, to round out and close out, one thing I didn't bring up with you, and again, I referenced it briefly with Josh, expecting to let you riff on it, and that is his female influence, the broodmare power, and the fact that two-thirds of his stake winners are female.
That's a great point you brought up with him. He definitely has had a Philly bias. You know, I kind of noticed this early on because I remember being at one of these Maryland sales in like early years when he first went stud, you know, 2002 or one, whenever his first yearlings or, and 2 year olds were at the track. And I was there with Jack Work, and he was there with some Russian clients at the time, and they ended up buying a filly by Malibu Moon, and that filly, nobody knew about it here at the time because nobody was even paying any attention to it, nor they do they really do it now, but she ended up winning like the Russian Oaks. And we suddenly realized, wow, you know, his fillies seem to be, you know, something else. That trend has continued onwards, and you make an excellent point, because with so many good fillies, this is the potential influence that you're going to see down the line with him, you know, being a factor in pedigrees to his daughters. And you pointed out in the part with Josh Bonds too that his son Gormley, first crop 2 year olds this year, they're selling like hotcakes. He only stands for $5,000 at Spendthrift. You know, he could be an heir apparent too. You know, he's a horse that once again could be a cheap stud fee horse. He's well raced, who could be the breakout stallion for him. There's a lot of possibilities.
Well, Orb is going to carry that that line to South America, and it might very well be very helpful. In fact, down there, and they love that kind of that kind of pedigree. And we'll see if Gormley doesn't go on with it for Malibu Moon. So
that's a good point you said about Orb going down to South America. And a lot of times a horse like that can end up being influential down there. Another Derby winner, which that happened to, was a bust here with Spend a Buck. But once he went to Brazil, he hooked up with these mares by certain stallions there. And that absolutely activated him, and he became an entirely new stallion there. And it's, you know, that's an option for Orb down the road.
Well, the name that comes to mind in terms of you know, going to Uruguay is Subordination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
went down there and you know is a huge influence. Shows up in countless South American pedigrees.
That's right. A lot of times those types of pedigrees come back here, and they're successful. I mean, you know, all you have to do is look at Candy Ride. His sire, Ride the Rails, was set down there and got Candy Ride. And now Candy Ride has come back here to create a new strain of Fappiano through the Crypto Clearance branch, you know. So, yeah. The stories are never over till they're over.
That's right. Until thanks, Yogi. I love it. Sid, I appreciate it, and I didn't expect that our conversation would share time. That Ron Bauer and Twirling Candy would, you know, would share time on the stage with Malibu Moon, but that's. That's what we do. We react to what's going on out there.
That's it. That's all.
I appreciate it. Sid Fernando, everybody, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, and you're brought to you by Hill and Dale. We will look forward to the Belmont. That'll be our, you know, start to look down the down to Elmont in a couple of weeks. Still some opportunity. You know, there's some, the Stallion Barns are still open. If you've got, you know, if your mare didn't take and you got decisions, you got late foals, you still have time. Get a hold of Sid and Roger, 510-490-1111. Work Thoroughbred Consultants. Sire Watch on your Twitter, and we'll talk to Sid next week.
I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks, Sid. Sid Fernando. We'll stay here. We've got about 45 minutes, and we'll spend 15, 20 of it with Bill Downs. He's going to join us here momentarily, talk about, we didn't talk last week, leading into Preakness, so we'll catch up over the last couple of weeks at Indiana Grand. And, boy, timing-wise, perfect. There was a carryover triggered by the 50-1 shot in the last of the Thoroughbred races yesterday in Shelbyville. Bill Downs, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Bill, we haven't talked in a couple of weeks. Catch us up. What's been catching the fire down at Shelbyville?
Well, I guess jockey-wise, you know, Jose Bautista, who came up from Tampa, he's starting to get more mounts, and he's starting to win a lot more races. So I think jockey-wise, he's probably the story there.
How about on the win front? I did actually last week. Where is it? I've got it here because I did notice, and I put it on the side of my desk, looking forward to our visit. Here it is. It caught my eye the other day. Here it is. Let's see. There was a sequence. I guess it was last Monday. I'd gotten down to Maryland and was watching, and then we had a whole different agenda that was foisted on us. The sequence, you had the pick five, you had a $5 winner, a $3 winner, $34.40, $18.40, and $13.20. You had a $3,850 pick five, and there was really nobody in the sequence that, you know, was a, even the $34 winner was not an impossibility. And I also did the parlay, looking at last Wednesday, caught my eye. This was unbelievable. Parlay was $717, and the pick five paid $2,932.
Yep. And it always helps. So you got the, you know, low takeout, 11.99%, and when you hit, you're going to get paid handsomely more times than not. Just glancing at the trainer standings, who's kind of started to get going. You know, Tony Granitz, who has horses up at Arlington and has been down here for the last few years as well, he's starting to pick up. He's winning at a very high clip. He kind of got here like second or third week, it seemed like, and then he started to starting to rev up as well. So those are probably the two that caught my eye the most in terms of jockey and trainer that has started to pick up here at Indiana
Grand. Nice. I like Tony Granitz. I does a terrific job, and I want to go to this sequence for a second from last Wednesday. You had the key. It just seems consistently, Bill, the more beaten favorites there are in any of these sequences, the crazier the exponential payout is. And that sequence last Wednesday, to show people, you had a third choice, a second choice, a 1-5 win, a third choice, and a third choice. There was nobody over 6-1, and the thing pays $3,000 essentially. It is so worth it to look through these sequences on a daily basis.
I agree. I mean, Indiana Grand is, I know I heard someone else talking about you know, how do you handicap Indiana Grand? And the person said, you know, you kind of have to, you know, keep track of it on a daily basis. You might not have to, you know, be actively wagering, but you got to keep up on it. And you can do that, obviously, very easily. Replays and looking at charts and stuff like that to get an idea of who are the players and what might have been happening on an afternoon.
Well, yesterday, it was not sure, you know, where the sequence was headed, you know, in terms of the return, but you end up with the 50-1 shot winning the nightcap, and it sends the thing into a carryover scenario. And I want to look at the sequence, just reaching for, where are the PPs? There it is, Wednesday. I got too many PPs on the desk, Bill. Here we go.
I hear you. That time of year, Steve.
For sure. All right, the sequence today. And I'm sure people are going to essentially handicap 10 races today, the 5th through 9th at both Indiana and then at Canterbury later. So you got a perfect – we have your afternoon planned out, starting at Indy and then shifting to Shakopee later. The sequence starts with a 7.5 turf second-level allowance optional claimer. And this is – what's nice about this is that it's a six horse field. I don't think, based on the forecast I looked, Bill, we don't have to worry about any weather issue, right?
Yeah, you know, you never know around here. It's you know, starting to warm up, and you never know with a pop up shower now and then. But I'm hopeful. Let's just put it that way. I know that there's going to be everything done to keep it on the turf. Even if we get a little, you know, light rain here and there, but that's at least the forecast that I know of.
Yeah, I didn't. It's funny. There's no place in the forecast does it show actual rain, but yet it was a 40%. They called it 40% chance, but it shows clear essentially all afternoon. So the first leg and the fourth leg, or actually the first and the last leg are on the grass. So this second level allowance, just six horses to worry about, but it's competitive. What did you do in here?
Well, you got a couple of favorites, Sharp Prospect and Spot City. I went back and forth. I made Sharp Prospect the favorite. Joe Sharp usually means business when he brings horses here. That's kind of the reason why I, this horse, even though it's coming off a long layoff, I kind of made him the slight favorite. But Spot City can certainly go off as the favorite. Wouldn't surprise me. But Spot City's last two races have been a little subpar. You know, finished dead last the last time out at Oaklawn Park. Now they're trying the turf for the first time by Street Sense out of a Malibu Moon mare. There's your tie-in, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I think they're experimenting here, where I know Sharp's Prospect is definitely a turf horse, and that last turf win on March 15th really showed a nice eighth of a mile kick to run down a leader that didn't want to lose, and he was able to go right on by that horse in that race on March 15th. Secretary Award, though, might be the price, though, Steve. He's coming out of a lot of sprint races, and early on in his career, he was a pretty good turf horse. He won a race at Del Mar going around the ground. And he won a little stakes race in 2017 at Aqueduct going around a ground. So he looks like a sprinter, but he has some past form. And he was able to win last time out. Yeah, it was on a wet track and a dirt sprint. But I think he's interesting on the stretch out. I at first I'm like, I had to kind of look, and I'm like, whoa, look at this. He's actually 2 for 8 at the distance. So I decided to kind of dig deep and find out where his turf wins came from. And I found those two turf wins deep in his past performances. So, I'm using him. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, fair enough. And that, it's funny, his presence in here, he's a horse that seems to turn up in all kinds of places. You know, it's been, how old is he now? 7. Yeah, going back to his time with Jimmy Jerkins. You bring up Sharp Prospect, away since last April, but certainly cut out for it. Spa City, of course, a 3-year-old last year, one of the last horses that Kieran McLaughlin trained before, you know, he retired from the morning work and turned to handling Luis Saez's book. This is, you know, street sense out of Sara Louise. You mentioned the Malibu Moon mare. You know, she was a nice stake mare. So, you know, this is a nice one making the turf debut. So you got some of that decision, a lot of that to do. Four out of the six are you know, moving over to grass. So you got a bit of a referendum on that front. Turn to the second leg. These are Indiana breds. They're going to go three quarters, and you do have, you know, some lightly raced and unraced types, most notably French Kid, the Izzy Garcia first-timer by Pataki Kid. In fact, speaking of Pataki Kid, Craig Burnick and Proctor came up a little earlier with Sid. Kind of a mysterious group, but there's a couple of obvious players, and I landed actually on the 8-1 shot for Barbara McBride, Shakanohei, which is a Cherokee word.
Yeah. There's some common races. There's the Unbridled Victor race, April 28th, and What Now Charlie. They both ran in 5.5 furlong heats. I thought the Unbridled Victor race was a little bit better. Benny Boo Boo, who finished second in the race, had a little bit of issue at the start, and then he had a dive over towards the inside and rallied for second. The fourth-place horse from that race, Actuality, came back to win a route maiden race yesterday at Indiana Grand. So that flattered that race a little bit. Sacred Sky got bet, and Sacred Sky is the eight horse in this sixth race. He hopped at the start, and then right after that, he got knocked by a rival, and he just kind of ran, you know, finished sixth in the race, 10 lengths off the lead. But they bet the horse in debut, and now they're adding blinkers. So if we can get out of the gate, I can see some improvement with Sacred Sky. You mentioned French Kid, first-time starter, by Pataki Kid. Israel Garcia had a first-time starter yesterday. I think it was another Pataki Kid. They share that common workout on April 27th, but then French Kid comes back with another almost a bullet gate workout on May 13th. So I think French Kid's tab is a little more promising than the Lassie Linda, who ran yesterday and finished fifth in a maiden race. I just think that he's a little bit more of a better prospect than Lassie Linda. So and then Weisskopf, I got to mention Weisskopf, first time in the barn of Randy Matthews, went off as looks like a second choice back in November of last year, had the lead early on. So he's a factor as well. So, you know, for me, it's probably, you know, I like Benny Boo Boo. I like Sacred Sky. And you know, the budget allows French Kid, maybe even Vice Cop. Those are probably the four that I like the most in that six race.
All right. I'm intrigued by Shakanohei. All right, so that now when I make my final call, I'm gonna have to dig into a couple of those. Bill, we've got back-to-back stakes for three-year-olds, male and female. The fillies start first. This is the Swifty sired fillies and Swifty Farm, and they're gonna go 5.5, and then the boys race, the eighth, the Sagamore sired, both 75,000, some lightly raced and some that have had plenty of experience, and a few that we enjoyed talking about last season when they were two-year-olds, like Hungarian Princess, who's going to be a heavy favorite in the seventh.
Yeah, she won a couple of Indiana stakes races last year, and she has a race under her belt this year, finished second in an open allowance race, lost to a filly by the name of Vinkaya for Brad Cox, who came into that race off a win in a maiden race at Sam Houston, and Vinkaya ran absolutely spectacular in that race on May the 3rd. So Hungarian Princess drawn beautifully, and she's going to be a popular single, but you know what? I don't know how you're going to beat her. Pearl Tiara finished third behind her in the Miss Indiana Stallion Philly Stakes on October 28th. And, you know, she's started to, you know, as she had more races under her belt, did better and better, even though her last race of the year was not that great, but she had a bad start in that race. She'd probably be the one I'd be focusing on the most if you're going to try and beat a Hungarian Princess. There's a couple of recent maiden winners Real Miss Prado for Tiana Richardville improved quite a bit in career start number two, but I don't know. She would have to take a major step forward to match up Hungarian Princess. Hungarian Princess just has a speed figure edge over most of the field. And, you know, it's probably going to be my single. I hate to take in the popular single, but I think there's nothing real negative about Hungarian Princess in this race.
No. Stylistically, you know, she has got tactical speed. I mean, she makes a ton of sense. Kim Hammond, you know, off to an okay start for the meet, and of course, last year we were all over the Hammond Bermudez angle. Hasn't been as potent so far this year. Talk about the boys' race that goes as the eighth.
Yeah, there is a key scratch in there. Dillsboro Devil is a
ooh,
scratch.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's going to change things a whole lot. You know, Sudden Shift is the four horse who I made the second choice in the race, got bet down as a favorite, but he won an allowance race. And he got the trip, and he delivered. So I give him credit for that win in April 27th. Bets Down Let's Ride took on older horses on April 21st. And I couldn't find an excuse, but like I said, was taking on older horses for the first time. And it was a pretty good field. So back versus three-year-olds and might be able to get to the lead in here, and that's might help him out quite a bit. But a horse who lost a Sudden Shift last time, I thought had a real interesting trip, and that was the seven-horse Sky Judge in today's race. But on April 27th, he sent for the lead. He got passed on the turn, and he got shuffled, and he looked like he was just shuffled from second to fourth, but he was actually in sixth turning for home. And then he advanced up the inside late, and that's not the easiest thing to do in a dry track at Indiana Grand. And so Sky Judge finished second in that race behind Sudden Shift, and he's going to be a much bigger price than Sudden Shift. But Sky Judge is going to be a horse that I'm throwing on my ticket for sure. So for me, Sky Judge, and you know, if I like Sky Judge, I guess I got to like a little bit Sudden Shift. Bets Down, Let's Ride, back versus three-year-olds. Are probably the three for me, but Sky Judge is going to be the biggest price of those three, so probably my choice in that Sagamore Sired Stakes.
I like it, and I'm in agreement on those three. Gets us to the last of the thoroughbred action and the anchor leg of the pick five, turf sprint, five furlongs, and thoughts in here.
Yeah, you know, it's a tough race. I made Boa Nova a lukewarm favorite at 3-1, dropping down from 40 down to 18 and dropping down a stutter or an allowance optional claiming condition. But he's 0-4 on this turf course, and so he is vulnerable. Outside is probably my top pick, the 11 Southside Swig for John Ortiz, a son of Dialed In, so not that bad turf breeding-wise. The Dam was a very lightly raised horse who hasn't produced a turf winner as of yet, but been in a lot of six-furlong races and getting the lead and then finishing third, second, and fourth last three starts. Shortest distance for Southside Swig in his career. I'm hoping he's able to get over from that outside post, but Southside Swig's probably my top choice. Oro de Tejano, the four horse from Randy Matthews, comes out of a tough starter allowance, second off of the claim. Lost to Greeley and Ben. Greeley and Ben came back to win a starter optional claiming race at Prairie Meadows in his next start. Now, Oro de Tejano doesn't have a win from six starts on the turf, and that's obviously a negative, but there's all sorts of speed in this race. Boa Nova, Roland with Olin, Southside Swig, all got early speed. Rob the Rich has got some early lick as well. So you might have the right running style. Scobie's got speed from the inside. So there's a lot of different ways you can go in this race. But for me, the top choice is Southside Swig on the outside for trainer John Ortiz.
I like it. I had trouble with this, to be honest, Bill. And the thing that at this time of year, and I also noticed it yesterday. In fact, I brought it up earlier this morning because of Canterbury. There's just so many of these horses that are making moves. Either it's a seasonal debut or you know, horses that are in form trying the grass, and it just throws a complete wrench, because in some cases you've got next to nothing to go on. You know, you look for some pedigree, and it's murky in a lot of cases. And you see horses that look fast enough on dirt, but that doesn't guarantee that they're going to transition to the grass course.
Yeah, exactly. So it's part of the handicapping dilemma, process, whatever you want to call it. You got to make some calls. And, you know, this is a race probably, though, that most people are going to have a few horses in the race. And so you're at least able to include most of your opinions.
Well, Sequence starts at just about 4:30, 4:29. And then, of course, there's a couple of quarter horse events that close out the card, but races 5 through 9, 4:30 to 6:30 essentially. And Bill, I'm going to write it up and take a swing. 61,000. Got to figure about 200,000 plus will be added to it. So, it's going to be attractive.
Yeah. We had a pick 5 carryover earlier in the week, and it was 29,000. We got it to like 140, so hopefully we'll get that 5 multiple. That would be a very healthy pool, to say the least. Wednesdays are our best day at Indiana Grand, so it's great timing to get another pick 5 carryover.
Well, and the turf, the stake action today too, and we'll start to have more and more of the stakes calendar to look over. Bill Downs won, everybody, on Twitter, and the action this afternoon. Get you going at Indiana Grand. Bill, I appreciate it, and we'll talk next week.
You got it, Steve.
Bill Downs, folks, and Indiana Grand, the action from Shelbyville. Just past the bottom of the hour, and yesterday you had John Hardoon talk about the legacy of Len Ragazin, and Andy Serling earlier, you know, referencing really what a legend that Len has been in the game. And you know, John talked about kind of the business end quite a bit, but I wanted to have Len Friedman, Len Ragazin's longtime partner, and really a perfect balance really to what Len Ragazin did and what Len Friedman brought to the relationship in terms of the betting and Ragazin's self-acknowledged nervousness when it came to applying the opinions. And Len, it seems like when you got together with Len, the magic happened. First of all, thanks so much, and I'm really, really saddened by the news.
Well, thank you for your sentiments, and it's sad, but he lived a long life, and he enjoyed it, at least most of it.
I'll ask you the same thing to start, really, that I asked John yesterday. How did you find Len Ragazin?
Well, a mutual friend suggested that I go over to see him because he knew that I was sort of a poker player and games player, and he thought we'd get along. So,
in the development of the sheets, as it were, and of the business, what point was it at when you encountered him?
Well, when I saw Len, he was working on the stuff maybe for about 7 or 8 years. I mean, the sheets didn't just sort of come out of the blue. They developed over a period of time as he refined the analysis, the single number for each race that the horse ran. And he had pretty much completed that when I met him. It was in 1965. And I was just astonished when I met him. I mean, I was a kid at the time. I just graduated from college a couple of years before that. And I was always a little bit into math and everything, but the stuff that he had processed and figured out, and this whole concept of distilling everything into that single number, just knocked me off my feet. I just loved it.
What were you doing at the time?
What was I doing at that time? I guess I was in law school at that time. I was in NYU law school at that time. I did complete that, but only because of the Kent State rebellions, because they canceled all the final exams my last year. And I don't think I could have bluffed my way through those if I'd had to take them, because I was already starting to spend time at the racetrack.
How funny. What as an origin story for you as well, what got you to the track? Was it familial?
Absolutely not. The only thing that got me to the track was Len Ragazin. I was at a racetrack a couple of times when I was a young kid, because I had an uncle who loved the racetrack, and he took us out there a couple of times. But I had never had any interest in horses, and I didn't know anything about that. I was a fairly serious poker player, sort of like a semi-pro, and I played a lot of different games, and, you know, we shared a lot of things. I loved to do puzzles, and he did, only he did them at you know, a much higher level than I did. I mean, he had just an unbelievable mind. And, you know, he would do these crossword puzzles. He would just look at them and just write the answers down. You know, he would just fill them out. You know, he'd hardly be looking at the clues. I mean, he did them so fast. I mean, it used to just drive me bats to watch that.
Famously, and there's been a series of wonderful, you know, different periodicals and other journals have really chronicled the Sheets and the two Lens, you and Len Ragazin. And there's a 70s era Sports Illustrated piece. There's a wonderful, fairly recent piece that I found on a website, and it's well documented that, you know, your wagering acumen, or maybe steeliness, ended up being, you know, a perfect complement to what Len was doing and did, because he didn't seem to necessarily have the wherewithal to apply what the numbers were saying to bet structure.
Well, it's sort of interesting, because he was playing when I met him. He was playing with bookies, because that was the only way to play in those days. There wasn't any simulcasting, and he had a terrible bad back when I met him. He was, you know, spent 8-10 hours a day in this specially constructed easy chair, which was the only comfortable place he could sit. And that's where he would do all his work. When he would work with the racing form, and when he was finished with that, all the charts in that form, he would just throw it to the floor and pick up the next one off the pile. And then somebody else had to come in and pick up all the papers off the floor, because he couldn't reach down to do it. And so he was pretty much housebound at that time. And he would bet with bookies, and he was doing fairly well. But his problem was is that they would stiff him all the time. You know, and you know, like I've said to a lot of people over the years, what was he going to do, break their knees? And, you know, he didn't have any recourse. And so the amount of money that he could make off of it was pretty slim, because the bookies didn't take much action in those days anyway on horses. They didn't want bets on horses because they couldn't balance their book. It isn't like bets on a football game where you can move the odds to get an even amount on both sides. you know, on horses, they were sort of stuck, so it was very limited. And he also didn't really have a good mental attitude toward betting. He expected to cash every bet, and everybody didn't cash. It was sort of like an attack on his ability to make numbers and interpret them. And it was just craziness. He all day long he would be nervous about how the bets were going because you couldn't watch him on television. He had no idea whether the horses were winning or losing. And then he would listen to this recap show at 5:30 that came on in New York every day that recapped all the horse racing results. Well, between 12 o'clock when he put the bets in 5:30, he was a nervous wreck. And he couldn't handle the tension of the betting. And it really was a big burden on him. And I guess that's where I came in, because to me it wasn't. I mean, it was just Monopoly money to me. And you win some and you lose some. I mean, you know, in poker games, you don't win every hand. And so it wasn't that kind of problem. And fairly soon after I started playing, I was winning. I mean, it was pretty easy in those days to win with the sheets. You didn't have to be any kind of genius. Everybody else was betting on class and pace. And what that did was it made for tremendous opportunities for people who just wanted to bet on the fast horse.
And of course, that's, you know, that's what the distillation of the figs was offering. You know, and you know, the fact that the class was really immaterial when it came to a, you know, horse in form. They don't know what their pedigree looks like.
I mean, when I used to go out to New York in the middle late 60s, I would say that in 4 or 5 of the 9 races every day, there was a horse that was going off at more than 5 to 1 who was solidly the fastest horse in the race. And they didn't always win because, you know, even horses who are fast don't always run fast. But they won often enough that with those kind of odds, you could just play those horses and just forget about any kind of sophisticated reads, which I wasn't able to make at that point anyway. And it was several years before I finally got Ragusan to sit down and explain a lot of what he'd learned about reading the patterns on the sheets. I mean, I picked up some things because they were sort of obvious, but there were a lot of other things which were a little more subtle that he saw that I hadn't seen. And, you know, that was useful because as time went on and there were more and more people using the sheets, those horses that were going off at 6 and 8 to 1 started going off at 3 and 4 to 1. You know, and today those horses are going off at 8 to 5. And, you know, there's been a tremendous progression over the years because other people have caught on that it's a good idea to bet on fast horses. And while they don't always find the right fast horse, they find it sometimes, at least some of them do, and they bet on that horse. I mean, today, I think more than ever, you have to figure out not who is actually the fastest horse, but who has a pattern that indicates they're going to run well.
And that, you know, that is one of the things that, you know, the pattern, the sheet read, the methodology, you know, has really going to have a lasting effect. I mean, it's changed. It really is, Len. I mean, the approach, and of course, it's been, you know, even further popularized by what by what Jerry Brown does as well. It has really changed not just horse players' approach, but even the horsemen themselves. And I did ask Cardoon yesterday, you know, about that part of the legacy that you and Len have, which is, you know, horsemen learning that their horses need time between races, that they're not automatons.
Well, I think that's true. What Ragazin discovered was that you could analyze a horse's performance against itself. That is, rather than just say, is horse A better than horse B, you can analyze horse A in terms of its own development and which way it's going and what are the probabilities that it's going to run well or run poorly. What are the probabilities that it's going to become a better horse over the next 3 to 6 months? You know, which is something that's been used a lot by people for claiming and purchasing horses.
Right.
That those kind of analyses can be made, that you can look at a horse's sheet and say, well, this pattern of numbers, the horse is gradually getting better every couple of months, is a healthy development. And you can look at another horse and say, well, this one every couple of months is slowing down a point or two, that there's something wrong there, and it's going to get worse rather than better. That those kind of analyses, I think, were really unique in the 1960s, that there weren't other people who were looking at it this way.
Right.
You know, and that was why class had such a big impact on people, because they couldn't see that horses were had a pattern of development where they could move to a new level or that they could deteriorate to a poorer level. And so they were always betting them.
And horsemen and owners. In terms of a tool, is really only part. And I really wanted to be sure that people understood what an incredible, generous human being he was, and his, you know, his political leanings, his philosophies, and the foundation that he leaves that will continue to do the kind of progressive work that was important to him. And I'd love for you to relate to everybody so they understand what, you know, how he lived his life and what was important to him in that regard.
Well, that was also part of the initial attraction that we had for each other. We shared a lot of ideas. I was active in rent strikes on the Lower East Side at the time, and we were both very much involved in the anti-racist campaigns that were going on in New York and all around the country at that time. I had been involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee for several years.
SNCC.
And he had been involved with a lot of progressive groups over the years. And those things were very important to us. I mean, Len lived a very Spartan life. There was a lot of money that passed through our hands in those days, I guess we could have lived quite well. I mean, I was brought up in a fairly well-to-do home, but I had sort of given up on that as a lifetime goal, and we were both active in the movements in the 60s. And we continued to be active throughout our lives. He made an enormous amount of money over the years, but he didn't spend it on himself. I remember once in the early 70s, when we sort of had a little coterie of people who were using the sheets. It was before it became a public thing. And it always bothered me that Ragazin never took a break. And so I got people together to chip in, and I chipped in a bunch, and we bought him a vacation to Puerto Rico. And he actually went, and he never forgave me for it. And he thought it was just a complete waste of money, and he didn't like to travel. He just wanted to stay home and do his work. It was really a strange thing. I mean, I was willing to take vacations. I mean, you know, I didn't go on yachts, but I was willing to take a vacation once a year to get away for a week or two. But he never did. And, you know, his biggest luxury was the apartment that he had, which was in an old labor union housing development in New York. It had a swimming pool, and he got to swim. That was it. And, you know, and occasional trips to a late night seedy Greenwich Village bar that he liked. That was the extent of the nightlife and relaxation for him. And he just didn't believe in that. He was very committed to, you know, struggling for a better world, and that's why he was doing this.
For those that haven't had a chance, and I'll put the link out later, the Len Ragozin Foundation, lenragozinfoundation.org, with further details and for promoting causes of equality and education, leadership, just obviously doing good work. And when he sold the business, Len, right? I mean, a large portion of the sale to Steve Marshall, right? Steve.
Yes, that's where most of the money from the sale of the business went to. He had always sort of planned on doing that, and I got together with some other people, and we figured out all the logistics of it, and that foundation is, I think, done good work. It's supported a lot of good anti-racist causes, and you know, I think it'll continue to do so. And
like,
you know, that's at least as much of his legacy as the sheets are his legacy. Because it was all tied together. I mean, the kind of drive and effort he put into the sheets was because we're raising money to support these causes, and that's what we were doing. And it isn't that we didn't enjoy what we were doing. We did. I mean, it was a great challenge, and horse racing has never been an easy game, and the take is ridiculous. And, you know, the take is four times what it is if you're playing any other kind of betting game.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, and in order to beat that, you know, you have to be pretty good. And you have to work at it pretty hard, too. And it's not like they throw the money at you. You have to go get it. And, you know, spend a lot of time. I mean, I in the old days, even though New York was pretty good to play, there were days where it looked like the better action was someplace else, and so you took the drive down to Philadelphia or to Atlantic City or even sometimes down to Maryland for a day.
Nice. Len, we're going to run out of time, but I'm grateful to have the opportunity to have you join me, and now that I've got your number, I promise to get you back.
Okay, well, I certainly appreciate it, and I like to celebrate Ragozin's legacy. He was a great man. He was very kind to me, and I treasure all the times we got to spend together.
Len Friedman, everybody, and the Ragozin Sheets and the Len Ragozin Foundation, and part of it, obviously, Ragozin's genius, and a lot of it Len Friedman's own genius and what he brings and brought to the partnership. We're going to wrap up, send you out into the race day. Two carryovers today. Well, Gus has got Canterbury. I'll do Indiana. Thanks to Bill Down, Sid Fernando, Andy Serling, and Josh Ponce to start us off to talk about Malibu Moon. Good luck today, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.